Moncrief on News Talk.
As you know, the indications are that later this summer, Andy Burnham will be unopposed in his bid to become leader of the Labour Party and the UK's new Prime Minister. And it will be historic in a religious sense, sort of. Boris Johnson was baptised Catholic but converted to Anglicanism, but then later flirted with Catholicism again. Tony Blair became Catholic after he left office, making Burnham perhaps arguably the first full-blown Catholic to be British Prime Minister. Is that significant in Britain today? Mark Paul is London correspondent for the Irish Times. Afternoon, Mark.
Hi, Sean.
In a practical sense, is there anything a Prime Minister as a Catholic isn't allowed to do?
Yes, it's written into a 200-year-old British law that a Catholic Prime Minister cannot advise the King on the appointment of Anglican bishops. And there is no real separation of church and state in England. The head of state, the King, is also the head of the Church of England. And Anglican bishop, the Anglican Church is the official church of the English state. And Anglican bishops, some of them sit in the House of Lords. Now, you know, if the King was appointing a new Archbishop of Canterbury or appointing new Anglican bishops to the Lords, the Prime Minister would normally advise on that. But it's written into British law that Catholics and Jews are not allowed to advise on that, but any other faith can. So, I mean, for example, Rishi Sunak is a Hindu, and there was no restrictions on him. But there is that practical restriction. I suppose it's a very small restriction in practical terms. It's the sort of thing that when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, he just delegated to somebody else. And if, as looks very, very likely, Andy Burnham becomes Prime Minister, he will have to do the same. But his Catholicism, I think, is more important to him on a personal basis rather than a practical basis, I would say.
Yeah. Has he spoken publicly much about it?
He has. He's always spoken about his Catholic faith. I mean, he comes from the northwest of England, where there are a lot of Catholics for two reasons. And number one, obviously, is migration and predominantly Irish migration into that area, into Manchester, into Liverpool and areas like that. But also, there were already a lot of Catholics up there because back in the Reformation, hundreds of years ago, there were a lot of what they call recusants. These were people who refused to convert over to the new Protestant faith. And Lancashire and those areas were kind of geographically out of the way. They were hard to get at. So a lot of, you know, those old mining pick towns and villages that he's just won this by-election in Makerfield, in that constituency, a lot of those old towns and villages are shaped by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church will have the biggest steeple if you look around in some of those towns and villages. It'll always be bigger than the Anglican one. And so there's a very Catholic feel there, but he's often spoken about how the Catholic faith shaped him. I don't think he's particularly observant or religious in that way, but he certainly is a very, very strong cultural Catholic, and he schooled his children in Catholic schools as well, and he talks about it quite a lot.
Yeah, now, and what I suppose part of what's interesting in that is that it's not the usual English Catholicism, which is quite kind of Brideshead Revisited type stuff, right? This is working class Catholicism.
That's right. I mean, a lot of English Catholics, particularly down south and in around London and in the kind of southern power bank of Britain, are sort of like High Anglicans almost. You know, the Catholic Church and the High Anglican Church, the bells and smells, they're very closely related. A lot of them come from wealthy background. I mean, think of Jacob Rees-Mogg, for example. I mean, he typifies the sort of upper class English Catholic. But in the northwest of England, it's different. That's where you find working class Catholics, either like Andy Burnham, descendants of Irish immigrants, or descendants of recusants. I mean, the main town where that Makerfield by-election took place, Ashton, the main street there, the Wetherspoons pub is named after a Catholic recusant. The St. Oswald's Church is enormous, and there's a Catholic club across the road from them. The church really shaped that area. And to an extent, I guess it's shaped Andy Burnham.
Yeah. Now, and so I take it from all of that, that the religion of an incumbent prime minister is irrelevant nowadays in modern Britain.
Well, I suppose it is. I mean, look, Boris Johnson was technically the first Catholic prime minister in Britain, obviously baptised Catholic and converted to Anglicanism. But, you know, with the Catholic Church, once you're in the club, they never let you out of it technically. So he was the first. Maybe it's moved past that. I mean, there was no hoo-ha about a Hindu being appointed as prime minister. Not really. Now, look, Britain is a country that at the moment is riven with divisions about race and identity and all sorts of stuff, but not so much about religion, unless I suppose maybe if you're a Muslim, perhaps you feel put upon by that by the nature of the public debate that's out there. But in terms of high public office, I don't think it's really such a huge issue anymore. But certainly for Andy Burnham, he has spoken about how his Catholicism and how his Catholic upbringing, how that enmeshed with his Labour views. And he sees Labour working class politics as almost like Catholic doctrine playing out in person, about loving your neighbour and about trying to help and charity and helping your neighbour and all of that sort of stuff. So he kind of squares that circle in his head in that way.
Okay, that's interesting. So he'd see the Catholic Church as being soft left. As things stand now, Mark, is there absolutely zero chance of anyone running against him?
A very, very low chance, not a zero chance. There are currently two possible contenders, one maybe, who might go up against Andy Burnham. So that is Darren Jones and Al Cairns. Darren Jones is the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, but it's just, look, nobody thinks he would be able to get the 81 MPs necessary. Al Cairns, who was the Armed Forces Minister who resigned earlier this month over cuts to over a black hole in the defence budget, he's kind of thrown shapes, shall we say, a little bit. But again, he's probably going to find it hard to reach the 81 MPs. But if he does get 81 MPs, for whatever reason, people might just want to see a contest. Well, that will push the whole thing out until September. But I think that will only delay the appointment of Andy Burnham as Prime Minister and not prevent it.
Yeah. Is there much speculation as to who might be Chancellor?
There is a lot of speculation about that. I mean, people would have presumed, and the talk had been for a long time, that if Burnham ever took over, that it would be Ed Miliband, former Labour leader, who lost a general election in 2015. But he's a kind of an acolyte of the soft left of the party, a standard bearer, really, of the soft left. But he's unpopular with the right wing of the Labour Party, and he's also increasingly unpopular with the kind of unionised blue-collar section of Labour, who want to bring back the sort of industrial jobs that they think his net zero agenda is destroying, the likes of North Sea oil drilling. So, you know, there's also the bond markets as well, which could get spooked by Ed Miliband. Mm. That is the argument against him. But he's still a contender. There are other contenders, and possibly John Healy, the former defence secretary, maybe Pat McFadden, who would be the first, I guess, son of Irish speakers to be the UK chancellor, the son of Gaelgor parents from Falkara and Donegal. So look, there are a couple of names floating about. It'll be the most important decision Andy Burnham makes as Prime Minister, because it will define his entire membership. Whoever controls the money controls the entire thing.
But whoever that is, they don't really have a lot of wiggle room to change things the way they are now.
No, they don't. And Britain's problem, and something that has hampered Keir Starmer and hampered Rishi Sunak before him, is that the country, is so heavily indebted. And it's so heavily indebted with a flaccid economy. So that's why living standards have been going down. They have to pay off all of this debt. They can't borrow huge amounts of money for huge infrastructural investment. Their hands are tied. They need their economy to grow, but they don't really have a lot of borrowing capacity to stimulate it. And that will be a challenge for Andy Burnham as well, and we'll see then if this Manchesterism philosophy of his, of business friendly socialism as he calls it, if he can get that going and get that off the ground for all of Britain, maybe he has a chance of winning the next election.
Yeah, given the week that's in it as well, the anniversary that was marked this week, is Brexit, is continuing relations with or improved relations with the European Union, is it on the agenda much, or is it still politically toxic to even suggest perhaps rejoining the EU?
Well, rejoining the EU isn't really on the agenda in any serious sense. Andy Burnham has explicitly ruled that out. But you've got to understand, he ran in Makerfield, which is a constituency that is very Brexit-y, shall we say. Mm. Two-thirds of people in Makerfield voted for Brexit, as against 52% across Britain as a whole. But, you know, Brexit is probably spoken about, I would say, more outside of Britain than inside it, to be honest. A lot of the talk about Brexit today were kind of jokes about the fact that there was a massive, massive, massive thunderstorm in London last night overnight, and everybody joked this morning that it was the gods striking Britain for the 10th anniversary of Brexit. But look, there is certainly a lot of talk about getting closer to Europe, possibly joining the customs union or the single market, even though those would be politically controversial on their own. The Liberal Democrats are obviously still pro-European. Burnham is pro-European. He has said before that he wants to see Britain to rejoin the EU in his lifetime, even if he has kind of walked that back politically in terms of his intentions as a future prime minister. Look, it's always going to be there. It's always going to be in the background. People, I suppose, the Remainers haven't given up on it. But I think the British national debate has moved on to other issues around identity and the economy, which may be tangential to Brexit and the issues around that, but not the central issue. I think, to be honest with you, we probably talk more about it in Ireland than they do over here.
Yeah, no, it's just but no connection is generally made between that flaccid economy you were talking about and the way it's been for the last 10 years and not being members of the European Union anymore.
Well, I think so. Well, look, I'm not saying that that connection isn't made. And, you know, I mean, there are various estimates out there about how many percentage points of GDP Brexit costs. And Rachel Reeves has started to talk about it, the current and probably, I would say, outgoing Chancellor of the Exchequer. And you know, in the last couple of months, Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer became more muscular about talking about the damage of Brexit. That was because, I suppose, the Labour Party had shifted into a mode where to fight off Reform UK in working class constituencies, they became, I suppose, more not welcoming of Brexit, but they basically acknowledged the argument that Britain had to move past it. But as they lost support out on their left flank to the Greens, where you'd have a lot of people who would be Remainers, they shifted back the other way in the last few months. So look, it still does. It's still a wind that blows through the British body politic, but it's not the gale force wind that you would expect. I suppose maybe, I don't know, maybe it just rustles the leaves still, Sean, if I torture that analogy to death, maybe.
Yes. Is Starmer going to, has he said anything one way or the other about his seat?
Well, he hasn't said anything publicly about it. I mean, I think there is such a degree of a feeling of betrayal that Starmer has. He feels betrayed, and he feels like he was done over. He feels like what's happened to him is quite unfair. And look, there are rumours floating around Westminster that he might just resign his seat. Now, look, his seat would be a pretty safe Labour seat, although the Greens would probably have a go at it. It's in North London, in St Pancras and Holborn. It's quite, you know, quite close to Islington and Kentish Town and places up there where Labour would be the dominant force. But does Keir Starmer want to be a backbench MP coming into the House of Commons as voting fodder and whenever they need a vote on and coming in and doing constituency work? I'm not sure he wants that. I think after Keir Starmer entered politics to become Prime Minister. And I think after being defenestrated as Prime Minister, I would imagine he probably never wants to set foot in the House of Commons ever again if he had his way.
Mark, thanks a million for talking to us today. That was Mark Paul, London correspondent for the Irish Times there. One Texas says, Great Britain is a basket case since Brexit, $1.5 trillion in debt and cutting every social service to try to get the deficit down. The best thing Ireland can do is take Northern Ireland off their hands. And somebody else points out, English Catholicism and all Catholicism is Roman Catholicism and not just Catholic. I, as a Church of Ireland Anglican, we have our creed. I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, which means all Christian church, but not separate Roman Catholicism, indeed. Well, but you know yourself in this country, when people say Catholic, they mean it's shorthand for Roman Catholic.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.